I next met with Dr. Aaron Gerds from the Cleveland Clinic Tulsa Cancer Institute, and to begin, I asked him if he believed there were any myths or misperceptions amongst general medical oncologists in a community-based setting specifically related to myelofibrosis or myeloproliferative neoplasms in general.
There's a couple of things that are still out there today. So one is that you have to have a JAK mutation in order to have a benefit from a JAK inhibitor.
Well, people still don't know that.
Yeah, I know you did the survey in 2014, and it's still out there. I still saw a patient in the last 6 months who was told that they're unlikely to respond to a JAK inhibitor because they don't have the JAK2 mutation.
Wow.
I don't know if that's what they're being told, the patients that I see, or it's something that they maybe saw on the internet, or they're just using logic saying, well, gee, I don't have a JAK mutation. This drug is probably not going to work. So I think the education gap is much smaller than it used to be, but there's still a little gap there. The other biggest gap I see in education is actually the role of transplantation. So I'm seeing a fair number of patients, say, in their late 60s who are otherwise very healthy individuals who have very high-risk myelofibrosis by whatever measure you want to use. And they're telling me, well, you know, I don't think I'm transplant eligible because I'm too old, or someone told me that I'm too old. And actually, we're seeing successful transplantation for patients with myelofibrosis up and through the age of 70 and even into the early 70s. So I think we're seeing some barrier there in communicating who might be a transplant eligible patient versus those who may not.
Interesting. Getting back to that issue about JAK mutations, maybe you can comment a little bit on the biology of MPNs and JAK mutations and the phenotype of these diseases at a basic level.
Yeah. So I kind of approach it in a couple of different ways. I think one of the major take-home points is no matter what the driver mutation is for the disease, all these patients have activation of the JAK-STAT pathway. And everything cascades from there. The cell proliferation, the symptoms, you know, elevation of cytokine levels and the symptoms that a patient may have, the propensity for genomic instability and progression to acute leukemias, it all kind of stems back to that initial mutation and the JAK-STAT activation. So we spend a lot of time focusing on what is the biology behind these mutations and how they cause these issues, and why do mutations in three completely unrelated genes cause the same disease? So we focus a lot on that. I often, in clinic, as well as discussing with trainees, use the thermostat and the furnace analogy. And so I take EPO as an example. So you have your kidney that senses red blood cell levels to a certain degree, oxygenation, right? And then if it's low, it sends EPO to the bone marrow to make more red blood cells. And once there's enough red blood cells, then the EPO shuts off, or at least it slows down. It's just like a thermostat in your house. And so I can explain to patients how, as well as, you know, early trainees, how the kidney acts like a thermostat and the bone marrow is like a furnace. And so we got to figure out, is it the thermostat that's broken? Is the kidney just making too much EPO for whatever reason due to a tumor or COPD? Or is it more of the bone marrow, the furnace is the problem, where it's just on all the time no matter what the thermostat's telling it? And I think that resonates with a lot of people in this area who have very old houses from like the 1920s. Everybody kind of gets it. And then I think, you know, a lot of else what we focus on are the similarities and differences between the three different phenotypes, right? The same genotype, say a JAK2 mutation, can cause three somewhat distinct phenotypes. So we spend a lot of time, well, what does a typical ET patient look like? And what do you got to think about long-term with them? What does a typical PV patient look like? They may have more splenomegaly than an ET patient, have the aquagenic pruritus versus maybe someone with myelofibrosis who will have the night sweats and fevers as maybe one of their more predominant symptoms. So we kind of say, well, although the genotype is similar and the pathophysiology is similar, they do have different kind of clinical presentations often. And then, of course, you know, after we kind of get through the genotype and phenotype, what are we going to do long-term to take care of these patients?
With that as a background, maybe we can see how it relates to some of these patients that you brought in here today. And why don't we start out with a 61-year-old lady?
Yeah, so this patient is a 61-year-old lady who I've been following for a little bit of time now. She was originally diagnosed with iron deficiency anemia a number of years back in 2014. She had a mild anemia with a hemoglobin down towards 11. Her local doc did iron studies as well as a ferritin, gave her a couple doses of iron, and then her hemoglobin came back up and she was kind of lost to follow-up for a few years. But later on, she re-presented with anemia towards the end of 2016. And so she was ultimately referred back to the hematologist thinking it was the iron deficiency again, and we kind of go down that route with the IV iron. But it turns out, well, she wasn't microcytic this time. And that kind of tipped the local doc off to thinking about, well, what else could be doing this? So she ultimately underwent a bone marrow biopsy that showed the kind of abnormal-looking megakaryocytes, or platelet-producing cells, as well as the grade 2 fibrosis. And that, along with her splenomegaly and leukoerythroblastosis, ultimately she was diagnosed with myelofibrosis, primary myelofibrosis.
And what were some of the key issues in assessing her and coming up with a treatment plan?
When I first saw her and she was first referred to me for a second opinion, she was asymptomatic. She felt fine. Her hemoglobin was 12. She says, I don't even know why I drove all the way up here from Kentucky to see you. But, you know, we did cover a lot about the disease and what may happen in the future. And her white count was a little high at the time. So her local doc put her on some hydroxyurea to bring her white count down from 45 down to 12. And again, it didn't make her any more anemic. So we kind of left things where they were. So since she was absolutely asymptomatic and had relatively low-risk disease by the Dynamic International Prognostic Scoring System, we said, okay, let's just continue with observation here. But however, over the course of the last 8 or 9 months, she's developed symptoms slowly over time, namely spleen symptoms. The main thing she told me at our last visit, her spleen was pressing on her chest wall, and it made it difficult for her to sleep. She had some early symptoms of early satiety as well, just a little bit of that kind of filling up when she eats, occasional night sweats. So these things were starting to build. And also, she did have an ultrasound of her spleen done prior to me seeing her, and her spleen was a little over 20 centimeters on the ultrasound. And on my exam, it was pretty large. Her spleen exam, it was 11 centimeters when I saw her in clinic. So now that the symptoms are starting to build, and certainly her spleen is over 10 centimeters on the exam, I felt it was time to jump in with some ruxolitinib to try to make her feel a little better.
And what was her mutational profile?
Yeah, so when the first time we saw her, we documented the JAK2 mutation that she had previous testing for at the time of her bone marrow biopsy. But we also do a multi-gene panel with 56 different genes at our institution, similar to many of these multi-gene panels that are done across the country and around the world. But we also found a second mutation, EZH2. So it's always tricky in these young, you know, these relatively younger patients who are somewhat asymptomatic, but yet have a high-risk mutation such as EZH2. So that's one of the well-established high-risk mutations. And how do you counsel someone? Well, you have this thing, this calreticulin type 1 mutation that confers the best risk possible. But you also have this EZH2, which could predict for progression to acute leukemia sometime in the future. But you feel fine right now. What do we do with that? That's really, I think, the challenge of next generation sequencing this day, is how do you kind of parse all these things out? There's helpful tools like the MIPS score, the mutational version of the DIPSS, the MIPS-70. They have an online calculator, which actually makes it nice and easy to use. You can kind of go in there and plug in all the patient information. It spits you out median survivals based on the information you input. And so you can kind of help to use that to incorporate mutation testing. But at the end of the day, you have a patient in front of you, and you kind of got to take all these things into assessment. But mainly what their performance status is, what their symptoms are, and what their spleen is doing at the end of the day, and make your treatment decisions based on that.
So you decided to, based on her symptoms, I guess, mainly to start on ruxolitinib. How did you think through dosing?
Yeah, so certainly there's dosing recommendations on the package insert for ruxolitinib, and it's based on platelet counts largely. Her platelet count was well over 250. I think it was getting closer. It was about 300 when I saw her at the time we decided to start ruxolitinib. So I felt very comfortable starting 20 milligrams twice a day. Again, she was mildly anemic. I think her hemoglobin was about 11.5 when I saw her and we were going to start ruxolitinib. So she wasn't overly anemic. She didn't have a lot of thrombocytopenia. So it was pretty comfortable starting the ruxolitinib at the dose of 20 milligrams twice a day. I know a lot of folks do start in with a lower dose in every patient and work their way up because, as one of my colleagues put it, thrombocytopenia is her worst enemy. We were having a long debate about what dose to start on. She's like, I hate thrombocytopenia so much. So I use some of this phase 2 data that's out there that shows that you do intra-patient dose escalation.
And what is your usual plan, and what plan did you have for her in terms of follow-up?
Yeah, so typically for my patients who I start on ruxolitinib, I like to check their labs weekly after starting just to make sure we don't have any precipitous drop in their blood counts. I've seen that on occasion. I also check liver enzymes for that first month as well. After that, I get a pretty good sense of what their blood counts are going to do on ruxolitinib, and I can kind of start to space out the blood count checking. I like to follow up with patients about a month after they start too, just to reassess their symptoms. I often use the MPN-10 as a measurement of symptom burden in clinic. So I'll check it before they start on treatment, and I'll check it a month later to see if they're having any movement in their symptom burden, as well as check their spleen.
And what exactly happened with her?
So after a month of treatment, she is doing much better. She didn't get up there quite at the month mark because she does live quite a far away from Cleveland, but her symptom burden has improved quite a bit. I'd say she has about a 40% reduction in her total symptom burden just after a few weeks of treatment. And her spleen is noticeably better. But the most important thing to her was the fact that she was having a hard time sleeping at night because her spleen was pressing on her chest wall, and that has become much better. She can sleep now at night quite comfortably.
That's great. What's been going on with her counts?
Her counts have been rock solid. Her platelets varied, as all platelet counts do, but really haven't dipped below 200 yet.
And what are you expecting for her over the next few years?
Yeah, so I would expect and hope for the best for her, of course. So patients who are kind of in this still have a relatively lower dip score, who don't have a really high blast count, who seem to have a pretty rapid response to ruxolitinib, often see that they do very well for a long period of time on the drug. If you look at the comfort studies, which ultimately led to the approval of the FDA label and everything for ruxolitinib, you know, patients were on drug 3-ish years on average. But it seems like people, at least in my experience, people who kind of get that benefit early on tend to stay on it much longer, upwards of, like, say, 5+ years.
And can you talk a little bit about some of the issues that come up when you use ruxolitinib in this situation, particularly patients unlike her who do start out with cytopenias?
Oh, it's such a challenge. I do agree with my colleague who bemoaned low platelet counts. It is really a challenge. You know, with anemia, we can always transfuse. We can try ESAs. We can try different things to try to mitigate the anemia while on ruxolitinib. But you really feel like your hands are tied when it comes to thrombocytopenia because you have someone with a platelet count of 30. You put them on any dose of ruxolitinib, you know their platelets are going to come down. They're going to be sensitive. So there has been two published studies looking at dose escalation in patients who are thrombocytopenic. Two older studies. So there was one, a pilot study out of the Cleveland Clinic, as well as a multi-institutional study that was published, a phase two, where both studies started out at a very low dose level and kind of worked their way up, either 5 every other day in one study or 5 twice a day in another study. And basically, as you start on these very low doses, you give your patient a month, and as long as their platelet counts are hanging in there, you go up to the next dose. You can escalate by 5 milligrams a day once a month is what those papers were looking at. So start out at 5 milligrams twice a day. You do well for a month. You go up to, say, 10 milligrams in the morning, 5 milligrams in the evening. Watch it for another month. Make sure the platelets don't take a huge plunge or you run into bleeding complications. And you kind of work your way up to the point where your platelets start to teeter a little bit or you're starting to see significant symptom burden and spleen size improvements.
What do we know at this point about the long-term impact of ruxolitinib on these patients, particularly in terms of the underlying disease pathogenesis?
Yeah. So in pooled data from the COMFORT studies, in pooled data that's for long-term, so 5 to 7 years of follow-up with these folks, we see that there is a survival advantage for ruxolitinib. Now, they've done some fancy statistical modeling that might suggest how long that survival advantage is, but the truth of the matter, there was crossover in these studies, so you don't have a precise number. You can only estimate what that will be. But for all indications, what we typically think of as disease modification, you're either killing off myelofibrosis cells or reversing scar tissue in the bone marrow. We don't see those things on a routine basis happening with these patients. When you take them all in aggregate, things are about the same. But clearly what we're doing, we are disease modifying because these patients are living longer. But it's likely through reduction of cytokines, improvement of symptoms, perhaps improvements in performance status and functional status. There might even be some kind of thought about somehow cooling off extramedullary hematopoiesis and the effects that that could have on end organs such as kidneys or lungs. So I think it kind of tampens things and cools things off. But as far as going in and killing myelofibrosis cells, reducing fibrosis scores or the mutagenic potential for clonal evolution over time, we're not really seeing that on a consistent basis.
And what about other JAK inhibitors, for example, fedratinib?
Yeah. So the two other drugs kind of moving along in the world of JAK inhibitors, one is fedratinib, the other one's pacritinib. So fedratinib, of course, was on an FDA hold for this Wernicke's encephalopathy story. At the American Society of Hematology, there was a poster that was kind of this expose of the Wernicke's cases in the fedratinib studies.
Could you kind of backtrack on what happened there? It was really amazing.
Yeah. So fedratinib was being developed both in the frontline setting, so versus head-to-head versus ruxolitinib, as well as in the second-line setting, so patients who have previously been treated with ruxolitinib. And the Jakarta and the Jakarta 2 studies were looking at that and really showed pretty phenomenal responses, and some would argue even better than ruxolitinib, responses in these folks with myelofibrosis. But there was this signal of Wernicke's encephalopathy over the number of patients treated, not just on the Jakarta studies, but even the pre-existing phase 2 and phase 1 studies. They kind of pooled all that data and saw, I believe, 8 cases of Wernicke's encephalopathy. And so there was a thought that perhaps somehow this was lowering thiamine levels and leading to these cases of Wernicke's encephalopathy. So they really did a deep dig on these cases, and they got the imaging, they got old samples and checked them for thiamine levels. They really did a very Sherlockian Holmes type of deep analysis on these folks. And really, it turns out that one case was confirmed Wernicke's encephalopathy. But the issue with that particular patient, the patient hadn't eaten in months. They were very debilitated. They were in ICU and they didn't get tube feeds and all these other kind of things that could have led to the nutritional deficiency that ultimately led to the Wernicke's encephalopathy. And lastly, they went back using various lab models and looked at, does fedratinib actually lower thiamine levels? And it turns out, at least in the lab models, it did not. So based on that data, the FDA lifted the clinical hold on fedratinib to allow for further development of the drug, which was a huge success and kind of a surprise for many in the field. And then subsequently, the drug is now being looked at and for possibly regulatory approval.
So you mentioned the fact that in terms of efficacy, that it seems to be very efficacious. What about cytopenias?
So similar issues with fedratinib as compared to ruxolitinib with the cytopenias. Really, I think the one drug that we're kind of looking to for these patients with like the extreme cytopenias, particularly thrombocytopenia, is pacritinib. So that's a JAK inhibitor where we can treat patients with kind of the full intended strength dosing and still not see the massive swing in the platelet counts. So I think with fedratinib, we're still seeing cytopenias. And all the studies that have been done have been in patients with adequate platelet counts, you know, over 100. But that population that kind of sits below the FDA label with a platelet count less than 50, there's really no medication for them.
What about patients who have disease progression on ruxolitinib? Do they respond to any other JAK inhibitors? Do they respond to fedratinib?
Yeah. So brings up a tricky question. What is progression in myelofibrosis? And then, you know, there's been a lot of international working groups and opinion leaders who have kind of come down with that. But I kind of simply break it down into a couple pins. There's the obvious progression of progression to acute leukemia or accelerated or blast phase, MPN. That's kind of a separate bin. But really, there's the symptom burden progression and there's the spleen size progression. And then the last bin, the third bin, would be drop in blood counts. So it kind of depends on which of these three bins. Is it more of the progression to acute leukemia? Is it return or worsening of spleen and symptom burden? Or is it the cytopenia question? So depending on which of those, you would have a different treatment approach. Now, for patients who have primarily symptom progression and spleen progression, kind of that middle bin, I think if you look across the different studies of second-line JAK inhibitors, we do see responses there. And that population sometimes does have a benefit by switching out to a different JAK inhibitor. And so that would be the population I think would be best targeted with these, say, you know, second-line, third-line JAK inhibitors.
What about pacritinib?
Yeah. So pacritinib had a similar story to fedratinib as it was on an FDA hold, which halted its development. There were two randomized phase 3 studies ongoing, the PERSIST-1 and PERSIST-2 studies. And actually, with those studies ongoing, particularly the PERSIST-2 study, the FDA put a hold on over concerns of increased cardiac toxicity and bleeding events. Now, the PERSIST-2 study was specifically looking at patients with platelet counts less than 100. Any patient with any platelet count less than 100 could go on the study. So we were getting patients on the study with platelet counts in the 10s and the 20s, often because they didn't really have a lot of other treatment options. And so if you take a look back at a lot of those bleeding events, they were going to happen no matter whether they were on pacritinib or not, in all likelihood. And the cardiac events were a number of mixed kind of events. There was no singular side effect that we were seeing over and over, such as everybody got heart failure, or everyone had arrhythmias. It was kind of a smattering of things. And then when they added in the rest of the PERSIST data, as well as some other earlier trial data into the bigger bin, the safety signal kind of died down for the cardiac toxicity. And so ultimately the FDA said, okay, you can continue to develop the drug, lifted the hold, but really wanted more safety data. So the PAC-203 study had been launched, actually just about to finish accrual. I believe 180 patients on that study, where patients are randomized to the 100 daily, 100 twice a day, or 200 twice a day dosing. Back in the old PERSIST studies, we were seeing more side effects and perhaps toxicity at higher doses, particularly the 400 once a day dose.
So I want to get into new approaches to this problem. And maybe one way you can do that is to hear about your 66-year-old man.
So this 66-year-old gentleman, so in the fall of 2007, he had a bone marrow biopsy because he had anemia. And he had the old-fashioned get a colonoscopy, didn't find a reason for the anemia, have another colonoscopy, still didn't find the reason for the anemia. And then it was noticed that he did not have microcytic anemia. He actually had macrocytic anemia. And he got his bone marrow biopsy, and lo and behold, they saw fibrosis there and kind of took a look at his counts and say, okay, you have some early progenitors in your circulating blood. You have an enlarged spleen. Let's check for JAK2. And that was negative. And so about that time, calreticulin mutation testing was kind of coming out, and he got tested, and he was found to have a type 1 calreticulin mutation. So that helped kind of seal the diagnosis of myelofibrosis. Ultimately, he was started on ruxolitinib at kind of a low dose, but he didn't really tolerate it very well. He actually developed transfusion dependence, even on such a very, very low dose. His anemia, when he was first diagnosed, was kind of borderline anyways, and then over time it became lower and lower, and adding the ruxolitinib in just kind of tanked his red cell count.
Incidentally, do you see any other side effects or tolerability issues of ruxolitinib other than cytopenias?
So cytopenias, without a doubt, is the most common and most difficult to deal with and is almost universal for folks. Other side effects we see, I've had some patients that get dizziness and headaches that have limited our ability to give ruxolitinib. There are some rarer side effects, but can be kind of scary, such as shingles and chickenpox reactivation. So we see that in increased proportion in patients with ruxolitinib. But I've actually had one patient whose shingles was recurring and recurring severely enough where I actually took them off the ruxolitinib. There's also some reports of patients who have lived in areas endemic to tuberculosis having tuberculosis reactivation. And there's also a question, and looks like definitive proof now, that there's an increased risk of non-melanoma skin cancer in patients who are being treated with ruxolitinib.
Non-melanoma skin cancer. I was just about to ask you why you would see, what was the other problem you were talking
there
about?
There was TB reactivation.
Oh, yeah. I was going to ask you, so what do you think the pathophysiology is for these weird infections?
Yeah.
Unusual infections, I guess.
Also, there are reports, I haven't seen a case myself, but there's been reports of patients with undiagnosed subclinical hepatitis, hepatitis B infections or hepatitis C infections that flare up when on ruxolitinib. So clearly there's something with immunosuppression in this drug and suppressing the B cells probably that are allowing these infections to kind of roar up in patients whose immune systems have otherwise been controlling these diseases over time. And that kind of makes sense now because ruxolitinib is being used to treat chronic graft versus host disease, which is kind of targeting these B cells and trying to reduce that inflammation. Why is this particularly happening? Not sure, but it's starting to piece together a puzzle of how this drug could be an immunosuppressive agent and be used in that manner.
Are preemptive anti-infectives recommended?
Yeah, so what I typically do is I just check my patients to make sure that they have immunity against varicella. Most patients that I see have had exposure to the chickenpox or at least have a vaccine. Most of my patients who are eligible for the shingles shot, there's a newer version now that's a killed vaccine, is very safe. So I often recommend that they get that prior to starting on ruxolitinib, or if they start on ruxolitinib, get it anyways, because now we can use that. The older live vaccine, you don't want to give it while a patient's on ruxolitinib for the risk that you might cause an infection. I routinely screen my patients for remote history of hepatitis as well. And then simply for TB, I just ask the patients, have you ever had TB or been in an area that's endemic for TB?
And what about the non-melanoma skin cancer?
Yeah, so I counsel folks on good sun hygiene practices, sun avoidance, wearing sunblock, because there does seem to also be a link between sun exposure as well and developing these non-melanoma skin cancers. And then we talk about regular skin checks and making sure that if you have an abnormal-looking mole, yet you go see your local dermatologist and get it lopped off.
Again, what do you think the pathophysiology is?
Yeah, I would suspect it's also an immune-mediated phenomenon. There's something about removing the immune system here that's allowing these things to flare up. So again, you know, the parallel I draw is to bone marrow transplant because we see non-melanoma skin cancers at an increased rate in post-transplant setting where patients get long-term immunosuppression.
Not to get too far off topic, though, you mentioned ruxolitinib is being looked at for graft versus host disease.
Yes.
Is it actually being used or studied or what?
Yeah. So there's several clinical trials ongoing with ruxolitinib in graft versus host disease, both focused clinical trials on different phases of graft versus host disease, whether it's acute steroid refractory versus chronic, as well as there's even an ongoing access protocol. So patients are being prescribed ruxolitinib off-label for the treatment of graft-versus-host disease, and there's also, again, an access protocol that is available for patients who have graft-versus-host disease but don't qualify for any of the ongoing studies.
That's interesting. I think ibrutinib's been looked at that also, or is it approved, I think?
Ibrutinib does have an approval, yes, for treatment of graft-versus-host disease.
Strange world, huh?
It is. A lot of overlap. Well, it goes to show you how much of a bugaboo graft-versus-host disease is, right? That we're willing to try anything to treat graft-versus-host disease and cool it off for these patients. And hey, we got this drug that is immunosuppressive. It lowers cytokine levels. They did some preclinical models, and it looked like, yeah, it seems like a good idea. So we'll give it a try.
Interesting. So getting back to this man, can you kind of pick up what happened at that point?
So when he was started on ruxolitinib, even though he was started on a small dose of 5 milligrams twice a day, his red cell count tanked. He became very anemic, in fact, transfusion dependent. So when we talked to him about what to do next, we happened to have the Simplify 2 study open at our center. And we talked about enrolling him on the study for the potential that he would get momelotinib, which is a newer JAK inhibitor. And in earlier trials, prior to the Simplify studies, we were seeing curious improvements in people's anemia. So really for him, he didn't have great symptom control or spleen control on the ruxolitinib because he was on it for a very short period of time on such a low dose. So we thought, well, this could potentially help your myelofibrosis symptoms, help your spleen size, as well as maybe even improve your anemia. It could be kind of a one-stop shopping for this gentleman. So we ended up enrolling him on the study, and he got randomized to momelotinib. The study was a 2-to-1, so the odds were kind of in our favor. He enrolled on the study back in 2015, and he actually had a remarkable response. So his spleen shrunk down. He had more than a 35% reduction in his volume. His symptoms, which were mainly fatigue, night sweats, and itchy skin, all improved. And he actually became transfusion independent and has remained transfusion independent by the Gale criteria, at least, to this day.
That is really fascinating. And, you know, obviously it brings up the whole pharmacology of these agents. Can you talk about what we know about JAK inhibitors other than ruxolitinib? Not only this, and what happened with momelotinib? It seemed like it was very encouraging, but I'm kind of curious where it is right now. I know there's fedratinib. Can you just kind of go through the various agents that are being looked at and how they're different?
So there's been a litany of JAK inhibitors that have tried to follow in the footsteps of ruxolitinib. And of course, as of today, there are no other JAK inhibitors approved for the treatment of myelofibrosis. So a drug like momelotinib is different, but kind of similar. So the JAK1, JAK2 inhibition, wild-type inhibition, is about the same. The interesting thing that we see with momelotinib and why patients were getting improvements in their anemia, and this is no small amount, this is roughly 50 to 60% of patients are having bumps in their anemia, bumps in their red cell count. Actually, we had an abstract at the American Society of Hematology meeting showing that it has a lot to do with hepcidin. So hepcidin is a master iron regulator in the body and is often elevated in instances of chronic inflammation. So we think about the good old-fashioned anemia chronic disease, often is due to the fact that hepcidin is very high and iron gets sequestered in the reticular endothelial system, as well as there's some other markers of erythropoiesis that get turned down. And what we saw is that momelotinib on dosing will temporarily lower hepcidin levels in patients. So the hepcidin goes down, markers of erythropoiesis go up, and then in between doses, the hepcidin goes back up, and the markers of erythropoiesis go down. And then so every dose, you're kind of getting this little bit of suppression of hepcidin, and we're seeing improvement in anemia. I think this is really important because now we're starting to understand the mechanisms of why people are having anemia in this disease. It's not just the fact that they have fibrosis in their marrow and it's just a messed up looking thing. There's probably actually other physiologic processes going on with the chronic inflammation that these patients have leading to the anemia. So it certainly has implications in myelofibrosis, but maybe in other diseases too. Anemia, chronic disease, is a big issue. And perhaps targeting hepcidin, and there's already medications starting to look at this, targeting hepcidin might be a way to treat their anemia as well. So that's kind of momelotinib. And so momelotinib, the issue was in the Simplify studies, they didn't reach the primary endpoint. In the Simplify 2 study in particular, which were patients previously treated with ruxolitinib, it did not show an improvement in spleen size over best available therapy.
So these were people who progressed after ruxolitinib or came off gutted cytopenias?
Kind of a mix. Patients who might have progressed, patients who were intolerant for whatever reason. It was a mixed bag, but patients previously treated with ruxolitinib. And the rates of spleen response were similar in the best available therapy arm as well as it were in the momelotinib arm. And you kind of look back and you say, well, gee, why? Is, well, the best available therapy for almost 90% of patients was ruxolitinib. So it kind of was kind of an odd mix. But you'd think that patients who are getting ruxolitinib wouldn't do well if they've already failed ruxolitinib, but they are getting some benefit. And it is able to control the spleen, even though if you're dealing with cytopenias or side effects, it still can work to a certain degree. So I think some of the design of the studies were a little bit challenging. They kind of, for lack of a better term, shot themselves in their own foot with these designs. But currently, momelotinib is kind of on a hold, if you will. Not an FDA hold, but the development of the drug is they're trying to rethink about how what's the best way to be moving this drug forward. I know the drug was recently transitioned to another company, and so they're trying to meet with investigators and people who've taken care of patients on momelotinib to try to figure out what the best way to go forward with this drug is.
It sounds like, I would assume, having seen this patient and maybe even others, that it sounds like something maybe that there would be really a role for.
I think so. The fact that you can improve people's spleens, symptoms, and their anemia, I mean, that's kind of a trifecta. It literally is a trifecta. It's three things that you're improving. Where we know ruxolitinib, we're not going to see those types of anemia responses in those folks. Definitely we control spleen and symptoms, but not these anemia responses.
So I guess there's not going to be a first-line rux versus momelotinib study.
Not anytime soon. Not anytime soon.
If there were, what do you think it would show?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think based on the existing data that we have, I think we would see response rates somewhat similar to ruxolitinib. I think if there was a true and true head-to-head comparison, and this is really just based on the biology, the IC50 or the inhibitory concentration of momelotinib on JAK1 and JAK2, both wild type, is very similar between the two drugs. And we really think that that's it, that the off-target effects are probably not as important, except for in the fact that momelotinib doing this thing with hepcidin as an off-target effect. But
so ruxolitinib doesn't do that?
Ruxolitinib does not do that.
Wow, that's interesting.
It hasn't been tested in people, but in preclinical models, it does not alter hepcidin levels.
Anything new in terms of using JAK inhibitors for other diseases, other cancers? I know at one point there was trials looking at pancreatic cancer. I think that fizzled out. Any other uses of these agents?
Well, there is a JAK inhibitor approved for the treatment of rheumatoid arthritis. And so, again, kind of getting back to the whole anti-inflammatory thing or immunosuppressive thing.
Wow, what is it?
It's primarily a JAK3 inhibitor, but it also has effect on wild-type JAK1 and JAK2.
Huh.
Not to the same degree as ruxolitinib, but still has effect on those. So I've had a patient with myelofibrosis and some symptoms and some spleen, but also had kind of rip-roaring rheumatoid arthritis. And so I worked with a rheumatologist to put them on this JAK3 inhibitor for the rheumatoid arthritis. And they've had some improvement in their spleen size and a little bit in their symptoms and a significant improvement in the rheumatoid arthritis. So whether they're feeling better because their RA is better or is it really the myelofibrosis is getting better, it's a little hard to say, but they are feeling better nonetheless.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah. The other area of development, of course, is chronic graft-versus-host disease.
Right, but no other cancers. That sort of fizzled out.
Yeah, that did kind of fizzle out.
What about other strategies, other classes of therapy and agents being looked at in MPNs, including antifibrotics?
Yeah, so antifibrotics. So there was a big push a couple of years ago looking for all sorts of antifibrotics, thinking that if we can reverse the scar tissue in these bone marrows, we could somehow improve hematopoiesis, really kind of get the platelet counts up, get the red cell counts up, and maybe even affect the long-term disease course. Now, the tricky thing is with antifibrotics, fibrosis is a symptom. It's not the disease, right? So these are reactive fibrocytes in the bone marrow reacting to this kind of proliferative cytokine storm thing going on inside the marrow. So you wonder about the disease modification, but at face value, it makes sense. In the preclinical models, we were seeing some successes. So one of the lead agents, PRM-151, had a phase 2 study, recently reported out at the American Society of Hematology meeting, and the results were kind of mixed. Certainly the medication is very tolerable, and patients can be on it for a long period of time. How much we're affecting the scar tissue, it's kind of unknown. The results, again, to quote a colleague, weren't overwhelmingly positive, that some patients did have improvement in their fibrosis, but it wasn't clearly happening in all patients. So you wonder long-term, is this strategy going to really pan out? There's been a couple of other agents looking at modifying fibrosis that really haven't shown much improvement one way or the other. I think the one area of antifibrotic that people kind of agree where we're seeing a lot of effect is either ET with a little bit of fibrosis or this kind of pre-fibrotic myelofibrosis with very low-grade myelofibrosis, where they're getting on interferons, and we're seeing some reversal of the scar tissue there. But that's a very narrow slice of the MPN pie.
What about immune strategies, CAR T, checkpoint inhibitors, vaccines?
So for CAR T cells, in all the myeloid disorders, whether you're talking about myelofibrosis, MPNs, MDS, AML, the challenge is really the target. CD19 for B cells is a great target because you can wipe out all the CD19 and patients can still have a somewhat functional immune system, functional hematopoiesis. You can get by without your CD19 positive cells. But all the really good targets for myeloid disorders, say CD33 or any of these myeloid markers, you're going to wipe out the whole marrow. You're going to get a lot of aplastic patients. So the issue is really trying to figure out what's a good target. Myelofibrosis is incredibly, and the MPNs are incredibly sensitive to the graft versus leukemia effect in transplant. There's definitely patients with persistent disease that when you withdraw immune suppression post-transplant, it goes away. Or there's the European data showing that donor lymphocyte infusion really can really improve long-term response rates and actually improve, again, have a big effect on relapses post-transplant. So clearly there's a graft versus leukemia. It's going to be sensitive to the immune system, but we got to figure out how to get at it with that. In terms of checkpoint inhibitors, a few studies have been ongoing, but it appears that the toxicity is going to be pretty high with those. This is a frail population, and we've seen it bear out in other myeloid disorders, particularly myelodysplastic syndromes, where the toxicity rates are actually really high and way higher than what you would expect, say, borrowing from the solid tumor world.
When we worked together a couple of years ago, it was Dan Pollier, and I interviewed him recently, and he was telling me the whole venetoclax azacitidine story with AML, and I was just so fascinated. Of course, it got approved. Has venetoclax been looked at with MPNs?
So venetoclax, it would make sense, right? So the success that we saw in AML in combination, it would make sense. We should try to maybe think about venetoclax in myeloproliferative neoplasms. There are some anecdotal experiences. I've talked to folks around the country who've had patients, particularly those with accelerated or blast phase MPN. So they're kind of heading towards acute leukemia anyways, if not already there, with varying success, kind of one-off cases. There is discussion about developing some trials with venetoclax, but not a lot of activity yet. I think the prevailing opinion in the field is that by itself, it's probably going to have very modest activity. And then in combination with another medication, it may be too toxic. We've seen this story play out over and over, especially since ruxolitinib came on the scene. The ruxolitinib came out and then, okay, the next move was ruxolitinib plus this, ruxolitinib plus that. And we kept doing that over and over and over again. But it turns out at the end of the day, it always seems to be really, really toxic in this population when we start combining drugs.
So just not to get too far off, but since I brought that up, I am kind of curious what you think about the venetoclax hypomethylating combination and AML.
So I think it's a bit of a challenge. I, again, did not train too long ago, but I trained long ago enough where the options were pretty limited. It was very simple. You either got induction or you got low-dose Ara-C / hypomethylating agent. Now we have this kind of bevy of drugs that have all been approved with kind of liberal labels based sometimes in very preliminary data. So phase two data or even interim study data. And how do you interpret that? Because in acute leukemia and myelodysplastic syndromes, over and over, we see in a phase two study, we see huge CRs, improvement in complete response rates, and big long-term survival. And then you go to these studies, and you're like, then you go to the phase three studies, and that goes away for whatever reason. Whether the comparator arm did better than expected, or for whatever, there seems to be a regression towards the mean. So some of these approvals based on single arms, I'm not sure what to make of it. If this drug, venetoclax, when we give it in combination, it seems to be somewhat tolerable. We got to be mindful of the specific toxicities with the medication. But if we can get patients through it, I mean, the response rates are impressive compared to single agents alone. I'm kind of holding my breath and waiting for randomized data because we've been burned before with single arm data, and it makes me very, very weary.
So let's get back to MPN. And why don't we talk a little bit about PVERA? And to get into that, maybe we can hear about your 75-year-old lady.
Yeah, my 75-year-old lady. So she's an interesting case. So she was diagnosed with ET back in 2006. I know you said PV, but we'll get there. So she was diagnosed with ET because she had a very high platelet count. Her hemoglobin hematocrit were a little elevated, but not didn't trigger PV in the minds of the docs that saw her. She ultimately got testing for JAK2, was found to have the JAK2 V617F mutation. And so she was treated as ET all along. She went through the drugs. She went through hydroxyurea and nigrolide, had a lot of side effects with those, was never really on phlebotomy early on, but ultimately went to busulfan. So she was treated with busulfan intermittently for a couple of years, which is an older drug, an alkylating agent. And of course, we're sometimes wary of busulfan because of the potential increased risk for disease progression to acute leukemia, because it is a leukemogenic drug. But it did a great job controlling her counts. In 2013, she didn't get any more busulfan because the doctor that didn't saw her at that time said, well, I'm a little worried about this busulfan. We have this clinical trial with a JAK2 V617F specific JAK inhibitor. So let's go on to this clinical trial instead. I think it'll be a safer option for you. So in 2013, she went on this study with the JAK inhibitor and actually did really well. Her counts were controlled for quite some time.
What JAK inhibitor?
So it's ganinitinib. It's a drug that has only been tested in a kind of a phase one, phase two study across a number of different MPNs, ET, PV, myelofibrosis, as well as both JAK2 positive and JAK2 unmutated disease. And again, the reason this drug is a little bit different is you look at ruxolitinib, it does not inhibit mutant JAK2. Only the wild type, where this particular drug did inhibit mutant JAK2. The responses were kind of mixed, and taking a look at the overall clinical summary of this particular study, it just didn't seem to be any more efficacious than the existing JAK inhibitors out there. So ultimately, the drug wasn't developed any further. But she did well. She felt great. Her blood counts were under great control for 5 years on this drug, and she really, really did well. But ultimately, she started had an emergence of symptoms, namely this really intense aquagenic pruritus. She would get out of the shower and just like almost excoriate her skin. She was uncomfortable all the time. Her spleen started to grow a bit too. And so ultimately, we took her off and tried to move on to other things with her.
Before you go on, you've used that term a couple times, aquagenic pruritus. Can you talk about that?
So aquagenic pruritus. So that is kind of your classic PV symptom where you take a hot shower and you get out and you're really, really itchy. Something about the warm water just induces the itchiness. Actually, there's a nice old paper that has a map of where the aquagenic pruritus happens most commonly on the body. And you can kind of map it out with your patient. Say, here's this map of aquagenic pruritus. Is this where you're getting your itchiness? And they're like, oh yeah, it always itches there, there, and there. And it's kind of neat to show them that kind of visual representation of how they're feeling.
Wow, that's interesting. So what was the next step with this lady?
So she had been through hydroxyurea. She was on anagrelide for her high platelets, but she was intolerant to hydroxyurea. So thinking about, well, what agent can we treat her with now for her disease? It was kind of out of the picture because she just had a bad adverse event with it and was just very resistant to going back on. And also at the same time, we noticed that it wasn't just her platelets that were elevated, but her red cells were elevated as well. She had a high hematocrit and high hemoglobin. And kind of taking a step back, we said, well, actually, your disease has kind of morphed more into polycythemia vera, which can happen. I mean, patients are sometimes diagnosed with ET, and then over time, we ultimately say, well, this is actually more like PV. And if you look at the criteria for diagnosis, PV always trumps ET. So there are some folks who say, well, you can have both, but really, we call it true and true PV. And so with that in mind, we had a clinical trial for a new medication called idesanutlin available. So idesanutlin is the MDM2 inhibitor. It's kind of a neat drug because it takes P53 and uses it against the disease. So we often hear about in cancer medicine, P53 is always a bad thing, right? P53 mutations are bad. It leads to resistance to treatment, more aggressive disease. And here we're actually taking P53 and using it to kill off PV cells. So MDM2 is an inhibitor of P53. So if you inhibit the inhibitor, you let P53 free and do its job. We see in PV cells, MDM2 levels are elevated. So this makes sense on a lot of levels to be a target. And in fact, there was a phase one study that was done in patients with PV and ET. Only one patient with ET was on the study, but the rest were all PV. And some pretty remarkable responses. We were seeing all the patients but one had a hematologic improvement, meaning good control of their blood counts. We were seeing reductions in spleens, improvement in symptoms, and actually marrows going from looking abnormal to looking normal. So you look under the marrow for a PV patient, you're going to see all these erythroid precursors. The marrow's just full of cells, not a lot of fat there. And then after several months of treatment with this idesanutlin, the marrow looks normal. Normal fat to cell ratio, the erythroid precursors are gone, and just really kind of amazing. In addition to this whole allele burden reduction that we were seeing. So really, we think that this might be a true and true disease-modifying agent. So we had the clinical trial open, and we decided to enroll her on the study. She has now undergone at least 3 cycles of treatment. her major side effect on the study has been low platelet counts. So she's run into some thrombocytopenia. And kind of the interesting thing is she has now had these really extended drug holidays where her hematocrit is under control, under 45%. Her symptoms are non-existent, and she's not getting treated. She's going 3-4 months a time without any treatment at all. And it's pretty remarkable.
Can you talk about PV in general? And again, any myths or misperceptions you see in the community about it?
So with PV in general, I think one of the common misperceptions is about being somewhat lackadaisical about hematocrit control. I'm still seeing some of that. Well, let's just keep you below 50. Let's kind of just see how it goes. Or, well, as long as you're not having active clotting symptoms, we're okay. And so that's clearly not the case. There was the CYTO-PV study that randomized people to really tight control versus kind of loose control. So keep your hematocrit under 45% or 45 to 50 will do you. And that study, even though it didn't enroll all the way, they actually planned to enroll 300 patients. They only enrolled about half that, just to had to close it due to slow accrual, still showed a significant advantage in the primary outcome, which was thrombosis risk and overall survival composite endpoint, a huge benefit, a 50% reduction in the risk of clots and death in those folks. So clearly keeping it under 45 is very important. And what I think is a little more unclear and a misconception that's out there is how you do it. Is phlebotomy better? Is hydroxyurea better? Is interferon better? How do you get to that 45, I think, is the big unanswered question. And there are some people who think that hydroxyurea is the best way to get there or phlebotomies alone. But really, there's not been a lot of head-to-head-to-head comparisons saying this is the right way to get down to 45% and do your best by your patients.
So this lady was on an experimental JAK inhibitor, but we only have one, as you pointed out, JAK inhibitor approved right now for MPN, ruxolitinib. What is the role of ruxolitinib in PV?
Yeah, so ruxolitinib does have regulatory approval for second-line treatment in PV. So it's really based off roughly the European Leukemia Net criteria for hydroxyurea failure. And what that breaks down to is folks who have PV, who need phlebotomies despite being on, say, 2 grams of hydroxyurea a day, so 4 pills a day of hydroxyurea. So those patients who are truly resistant and kind of proliferating right through the hydroxyurea. And the other half of that criteria is folks who are intolerant. So they get side effects where they just can't take the drug, whether it's mouth sores, poor wound healing or ulcers, bad GI upset, and those types of things.
So when you do choose to use ruxolitinib, how effective is it?
So it has its pluses and minuses. So I would say the big upside is the fact that it can control hematocrit and certainly spleen size. I think really, that's where its major advantage is. So you get a patient whose hematocrit is a little out of control. The hydroxyurea is not really holding them like you would. They're needing some phlebotomies, but also their spleen is big and they're starting to get symptoms from their spleen. Or may have other symptoms such as the aquagenic pruritus or night sweats. And getting them on ruxolitinib kind of cools all those things down and really can help the patients feel a lot better and have a better quality of life. Now, in terms of purely controlling hematocrit, it can. If you look at the original randomized studies with ruxolitinib, it can control the hematocrit in roughly, you know, 60% of patients. But I think you can always do that with a lot of times with hydroxyurea and phlebotomy as well. But the real advantage is getting at those symptoms. The same symptoms that we see in myelofibrosis can be helped in patients with PV when they get on ruxolitinib. And to me, that's the big win for those folks.
So let's finish by talking about ET. And you have a patient here. I mean, you can talk about her.
This is a 45-year-old lady who really had no medical history until 2008 when she had this kind of persistent headache. And ultimately, it turned out to be a left retinal artery occlusion. She was on birth control pills at the time, and they thought, it might be these oral contraceptive pills, although it's unclear because she'd only been on it for a few days when she had this clot. And then she went through this very intense workup looking at all the different vasculature of her brain, and they did notice a few other clots along the way there. She really had no other past medical history that was relevant at the time, but once I saw her a little bit later on, we kind of dug back. She did have some issues with placental insufficiency with the birth of one of her children. So you wonder if she wasn't having blood clots with the placental insufficiency, and maybe it was due to the ET that we diagnosed later on. So with the persistent headaches and the thrombosis in her vasculature of her brain, particularly the venous side of her brain, she kind of got passed around a little bit. She started on anticoagulation, and then she was referred to a hematologist for a hypercoagulable workup. And they said, well, gee, I'm kind of worried about essential thrombocythemia because I see your platelets are a little elevated. In the past, they weren't particularly elevated. They were running about 400, 405, 410. So it didn't really trigger anyone's thought to think about this could be ET. But by the time she got to the hematologist for a hypercoagulable workup, they were up about 450 or so. And so JAK2 testing was done, and she was ultimately found to have a JAK2 V617F mutation. And given her kind of high risk, having had blood clots that were suspected to be related to her ET, looking back, it was felt like it was proper to give her some sort of cytoreductive therapy. By the time I saw her, her platelets had drifted up until about the 700 range. So there was a little bit more room to go there. But again, given the fact that she has a JAK2 mutation, particularly a JAK2 V617F mutation, and had a history of thrombosis, by the revised IPSET score, which is the score we used to kind of determine who really needs cytoreduction and who doesn't, she certainly qualified as high enough risk to warrant cytoreduction. So I had a long conversation with her because there is no FDA-approved treatment for the treatment of ET. And in younger patients, we always kind of debate, well, what's the right thing to do? And we discuss the main two treatment options that are available. One is hydroxyurea, as well as interferon. There's another option called anagrelide. And I usually put that third on the list because in randomized controlled trials, two of them, anagrelide wasn't any better in one study than hydroxyurea, and in the other study, it was actually inferior. So clearly hydroxyurea as compared to anagrelide is the way to go, but there's still minimal head-to-head data of hydroxyurea versus pegylated interferon. And of course, there's a lot of excitement about pegylated interferon given its potential effects on allele burden and perhaps disease modification. So I always like to inform patients about that and help them make the best decision possible when picking a treatment. This particular lady, she wasn't very excited about giving herself shots every week and the potential side effects of the interferon, namely the flu-like symptoms and possible depression. And so she ultimately decided to go on hydroxyurea. And we've put her on a very small dose. She's on 500 milligrams a day of hydroxyurea. It's brought her platelet count down nicely, and she hasn't had any other thrombotic events since.
What's the target platelet level in this situation?
That's the magic question, the million-dollar question there. So clearly for PV, we have a number. The hematocrit needs to be 45% or less, or less than 45%. For platelet counts in ET, there is no magic number. There's no, you got to get them under 60, you got to get them under 400, you got to get it under 800. There's no magic number. If you're treating someone with cytoreductive therapy, probably you want to get less than 800. I think most people will agree with that. Getting it down to normal may not be completely necessary. So in between that range, between the 400 to 800 range, I kind of take it on a case-by-case basis. In some patients, I think controlling it down to 600 is adequate. Some patients, like this lady who had a pretty extensive clot history, I'm very aggressive about lowering the platelet counts if I can. As long as we're not bottoming out her red cell counts or her white cell counts, I'll try to get the platelet count into the normal range.
Any myths or misperceptions you see out in the community regarding ET?
So I think there's a couple of misperceptions. One, that everybody needs aspirin. So aspirin is kind of a tricky subject in ET. There's no prospective data, certainly no prospective randomized data, support the use of aspirin in ET, say comparing aspirin versus no aspirin. Now that's all extrapolated from polycythemia vera. There are clinical trials that did include aspirin as part of their treatment regimen, but is also looking at other things, so it's hard to say. And as we kind of get into the molecular genetics of each of these diseases, it's clear that the patients with JAK2 V617F mutations are way more likely to clot than, say, folks with calreticulin mutations. And in fact, patients with calreticulin mutations may have a higher tendency for bleeding, particularly on aspirin. So for, say, a lower-risk patient who has a calreticulin-mutated ET, I don't necessarily recommend aspirin for them unless they are having symptoms that I think aspirin can help make them feel better. Say they are having headaches or other microvascular disturbances, I might go with the aspirin. But for someone who's relatively asymptomatic, wouldn't necessarily add in the aspirin for them.
So the last thing I want to ask you about is just to take a breath and talk a little bit about what happened at ASH. You mentioned a couple of things already in terms of MPNs that you think docs in practice should know about.
Yeah. So I think a couple of things happened at ASH. One is interferon is still there. I think we're still investigating it. I think it's a good treatment option. And it's certainly something to read about, kind of catch up on, and have in your toolkit to take care of MPN patients. I've used quite a bit of it, and I find it very helpful to have that option to reach for when patients either don't want to go on hydroxyurea or are intolerant to hydroxyurea and you want to use something else, I think it can be a very valuable tool. It's sometimes a challenge to get through the approval process in terms of prior authorizations and things. And it is a little tricky. It takes a little practice getting used to the drug in prescribing and managing it. But I think it can be a really useful tool. And a lot of the data that came out of ASH is showing that, yeah, it can be very helpful and can be very useful. The one trial in particular, the MPD-RC-112 study, was a head-to-head comparison of interferon versus hydroxyurea in ET and PV patients. Response rates were kind of the same. The amount of side effects were about the same. They had different side effects and different improvements in symptom burdens and things, so you kind of parse it out in the details there. But still, I think it's a great option. Other things from ASH is we've looked at a couple of different combination studies. One that was shown using a PI3 kinase delta inhibitor, which was showing some improvement in symptom burdens in combination with ruxolitinib. So these were patients who were on ruxolitinib for their myelofibrosis, had either a plateau or worsening of their symptoms, and we added back in this PI3 kinase delta inhibitor. And we did regain symptom control in a fair number of patients. Now, this is an interim analysis of a phase 2 study, so it's a little early to say what that's going to show over time. But this add-back strategy, I think, is something that's going to be more and more common, and we're seeing more and more studies being developed with this add-back strategy. So I think it's something we're going to see in the future.
Do you think it's encouraging enough that maybe it's going to make its way into practice?
Potentially, or at least this particular mechanism of action. So there's already PI3 delta kinase inhibitors approved, and there's a large number of other ones in development. So it might be one of these situations where we're looking at this mechanism as a whole. We look across the class of medications, and if this one doesn't particularly make it forward, we might be able to find another one.
When you talk about other PI3 kinase, are you talking about capanlisib and those drugs?
Yep, those drugs in particular.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for MPN Update.